Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Today on the show, it's film, theater, opera, and finding your own voice. Internationally acclaimed performance artist Tim Miller is in town for a Wake Forest University production of Vox, a powerful, exciting, and humorous student ensemble work based on their own personal stories. We'll hear a sample today. If you're someone who thinks that movies have the power to transform us, then Butter Burkus and Centenary United Methodist Church has an invitation just for you. Their Faith in Film series is going on every Sunday this month, and this year's lineup is a life and death matter, literally. Then it's a life and death battle played out on stage between Ludwig van Beethoven and an obsessed musicologist. Why did Beethoven write those 33 variations after all? Festival stage and Wake Forest University have the answer. And speaking of obsessed musicologists, just kidding, Peter, it's Understanding Classical Music with Peter Karoff at the keyboard. He's got Bach on the brain and a little thing called fugue next on Triad Arts Weekend. Imagine being able to develop a unique performance from the ground up with the mentorship of an internationally acclaimed performance artist. Well, that's exactly what a group of 17 Wake Forest University students will enjoy over a three-week residency with Tim Miller and their production of Vox. The student ensemble work is based on their own personal stories, experiences, and memories. Vox, which is Latin for voice, has been described as an exploration of big mouths and full-throated tales with all the humor, passion, and intensity of the human experience. It opens tonight, February 1st, and runs through the 10th with evening performances at 7:30 and a Sunday matinee at 2 in the Ring Theater of the Scales Fine Arts Center on the campus of Wake Forest University. Tim and Wake Forest student body president and performer Trey Easton drop by to talk about it. Trey began with a short excerpt from his piece in Vox.
My soul is on fire. It is. My soul is on fire. It's a living, breathing, insatiable that drives everything I do. It was born in sin and shaped in fabulous. It is not satisfied by the strange fruit that would easily satisfy others. No, it won't be silenced. It won't be made victim. It won't fall prey to the snares of its rural Georgia upbringing. No, it wants, it craves, passion. It needs answers. No, it demands answers. It needs purpose. Have you ever met a person whose soul does not have purpose? It runs around the universe trying to connect to other souls, but it can't because it doesn't know what it needs. I would hate those types of souls, but you see, my soul is incapable of hate. Hate kills souls, and my soul wishes to live forever with its delusions of grandeur. You see, I've always found that my soul is the confluence of all the things that we are told are not allowed to reside in souls. The black, the gay, the leader, and the Lord. My soul loves the Lord. The good Lord. Not the one who kills gay people and tells Michelle Bachmann to run for president. And now it wants to cry. Crying cleanses the soul and rejuvenates the flame. I want my soul to spark a fire in other souls and build a legacy. One impenetrable by man. Yes. My soul is on fire and I dare not ease the burn.
Wow, powerful stuff. Trey Easton, performer, Wake Forest University student body president. And Trey, did you write the work?
I did. It was completely written through the system that Tim Miller has so wonderfully developed. And it's just sort of the product of a week of intense work and training.
Prior to that, just by way of background, I mean, had you written poetry before, essays?
I write everything. You know, I love words. I love the power that words have. And so over my life, I've kind of prided myself in expressing my thoughts through words. And so I guess this is sort of the development of that.
Well, I want to dive into the process with Tim Miller, who's here with us as well, in just a minute. But first, in terms of your own experience and the synthesis of taking that template and filtering right. your own work through that. What was that experience like, and what did it give you?
This is the second time that I've performed with Tim and worked with Tim. The whole process is very gratifying because it takes you into very different levels of yourself, and you get very in tune with your own thoughts and your own messy insides. And so by the time you have a finished product, it's this gratifying release. And every time you get to do that, I think it's very cathartic for the soul, and I love it.
What cues you're getting from Tim, right. how did you then work that into your work, right. and what did it elicit new right. in the way you approached your right. writing?
So this time it's a 3-week long process, which is wonderful, but last time he came, it was a 1-week long process, and every rehearsal, Tim presents a prompt, and we sort of develop our own individual piece for that specific night. So every night, you're generating new material that will obviously end up in your finished piece. Some examples of prompts would be, you know, to think about moments that you want to change about your life, moments where you use your voice to speak up, moments where you want to actually have a life transformation. So you think about these things and you develop your individual piece for that night, present it for the rest of the group, and then hopefully put it inside the work that you're developing as the final product.
Okay, I interview artists every day,
right.
and at some level, we're all invested in our art, and,
right.
and I witness that dedication to craft, which is really inspiring from this end of the microphone, but I'm only imagining that this sort of project elicits deep emotional
right.
responses. What are
oh,
some
definitely.
Examples of that during the process where you maybe even surprised yourself with coming across, oh, I didn't realize that about
yeah.
myself?
That's so funny that you say that, because there are moments, and I think every person who's a part of this process has a moment where they are actually saying and vocalizing things they would never actually say and vocalize in front of other people. Every night, I think there's been some sort of emotional response that someone has with some sort of connection, with some sort of event that's happened in their past. They're now choosing to express comfortably with other people present. So it's very emotionally strong, and everyone really, I love the fact that everyone really gets very committed to it. But the other end of that is that you actually are going through a very raw experience. And I would characterize it as raw because you're really investing in yourself and going into the very deep, dark recesses of your mind in some instances, places that you don't really want to visit. But I tell you, the end result is always something very powerful that moves people.
Mm. Well, I really appreciate that. And what a great entree into your work. And 3 weeks here with Tim Miller and the interaction with these Wake students. Tim, from your perspective, I mean, after being awarded many NEA Solo Performer Fellowships, this one, because of the gay themes in one of your works, the NEA 4 successfully overthrew this violation of the First Amendment rights. I mean, how has the landscape changed in terms of your art since then?
Well, it's appropriate for us here in Winston to talk about this, since the culture war started just down Rinalda Road at SECA when your then senior senator Jesse Helms declared war on the arts in 1989 and 90 with a show in the gallery at the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art. I just love, since I drive by it all the time when I'm in Winston, they think it's the Fort Sumter of the culture war, to go all Civil War. But at a certain point, the then, you know, troubled senior senator of North Carolina, Jesse Helms, who seems a distant memory to mm-hmm. me now, though, you know, he was senator not that long ago,
right.
decided by attacking artists, especially lesbian and gay artists and artists of color who did work that was at all challenging, was going to burnish his bona fides as a extreme right-wing firebrand, and began attacking artists. And most visibly, and the only case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court, was attacking myself and three other performers in the so-called National Endowment for the Arts 4. Three of the four of us were lesbian or gay, and Karen Finley, that was the next best thing. So in some strange way, that whole battle bonded me with North Carolina in a way. I work in this state a great deal, more than almost any other state in the country, outside of California and New York, the two states I've lived in. I think partly because so many folks in North Carolina were so annoyed with Jesse Helms, people started bringing me, I think, as a little thumb nose to the embarrassing senator in Washington. So it's kind of connected me with this particular community. And Wake is a place I've been maybe 9 or 10 times at this point. But that period of culture war, which is ongoing, I mean, every year there's, you know, more incidents where people try to shut down a lesbian or gay performer or an artist of color who's bringing politics into their work in a way that's rocking the boat somehow. And we, of course, now as a government, no longer fund individual artists. It's sort of one of my negative legacies that out of our Supreme Court case, you know, which we essentially won our grants back, but the National Endowment for the Arts stopped funding individual artists altogether, except for writers, you know, but theater artists, performers, dancers, They just got rid of those. Artists, you know, were too afraid of artists in the United States to think we could actually support individuals.
You've had several short-term residencies at Wake, and I'm wondering some highlight moments or exchanges or moments that surprised you. From your perspective, I mean, these sorts of residencies, I imagine, are all-encompassing for the artist as well as the student.
There literally are so many moments. And I can think of just individual performances that young artists here in Winston, either at Wake or at North Carolina School of the Art, just powerful pieces around race, around a young African-American artist, sophomore, really dealing with the racism he experienced in an institution, also worked it through, found a way to create new family. A young artist did a piece about the North Carolina forced ultrasound law. You know, and we talk, you know, this has been one of the major political discourses in our country, especially in North Carolina, Virginia, the, you know, laws forcing women to receive an invasion of their body, an ultrasound, if they wanted to get an abortion. And, you know, this is not my issue. I've never done work about it. Her piece made me, quite aside from politics, really made me understand, okay, this is what it is to be 19 years old, having your body invaded and being forced to look at this television screen. It almost melted the entire building the performance was in. It was so honest and so intimate, and it's one of the most powerful things I've ever witnessed. As all those social discourses were happening on Fox or MSNBC, depending on your politics, I used her performance to really understand, okay, this is what we're talking about. A young 19-year-old North Carolinian weeping on an examining room because the laws of her state force her body to be invaded, you know, by law. It's such an, talk about big government. So to me, that's, I think, what performance does. It helps us really get it, not just politically, not just the theater of Washington, but the real heart of our bodies, our cells, our skin. And that's, I think, what theater does well and what the artists I'm working with in Vox are really pulling powerfully forward.
Tim, what do you hope the audience, what sorts of things do you hope they leave the auditorium with after this performance of Vox?
Well, I think they'll have a really, really vivid impression of the incredible resources, honesty, artistry, courage of 17, 18 to 22-year-old American citizens who are currently students at Wake. And that it, I think it will fill people with hope. Man, we are cooking with gas, that things are, these are brave, bold, new artist citizens who are ready to look at their lives. The work is huge and roomy and generous in its reach around humanity and spiritual self and things people want to move and visions. You know, the one student may be worried a parent is coming. Another student is making a piece of such beauty as a tribute to her mom who gave up some of her hopes as a singer to raise her and her sibling, you know. So when those parents are in the audience, what a powerful thing that parent is going to receive, her child there acknowledging her sacrifice, you know. I mean, and to me, that's as important an honesty as challenging a parent for me to create the tribute to the parent. So I think the piece is going to create about an hour-long journey of real sense of possibility and hope and community there in the Ring Theater. And we're performing in the round. We're making it a true round. And I think the audience will be aware of each other. I think the pieces will be funny. There's a lot of humor in it, a lot of beautiful storytelling, tremendous poetics. It's going to be a very thrilling piece of devised theater that we've made.
Wake Forest student body president and performer Trey Easton and internationally acclaimed performance artist Tim Miller. Tim has taught performances at UCLA, NYU, and universities all over the U.S., and he's currently in the midst of his three-week residency here in the Triad, working with 17 students at Wake Forest University. Their collaborative performance is Vox, a powerful, exciting, and humorous student ensemble work based on their own stories. You'll find links to more information at wfdd.org/triadarts. It'll run from February 1st through the 10th, with evening performances at 7:30 and a Sunday matinee at 2 in the Ring Theater of the Scales Fine Arts Center on the Wake campus. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Emmy Wilson Burkus, or Butter as she's best known, loves film. And for the past 5 years, she's brought her passion for cinema to a fascinating series at Centenary United Methodist Church in Winston-Salem. It's called Faith in Films, with free screenings and discussions every Sunday in February beginning at 2 o'clock. This Sunday is Ross McElwee's Time Indefinite. Werner Herzog's Grizzly Man is the following week. And this season, Errol Morris's Gates of Heaven and French filmmaker Chris Marker's Sans Soleil round out the series, which this year will explore the relationship of cinema to religion as a co-belief system. Butter has selected Duke Professor of Fiction and Nonfiction Filmmaking Gary Hawkins to give the pre-screening lectures and to moderate discussions following each film. Gary is the screenwriter on Joe, a motion picture produced in the fall of 2012, directed by David Gordon Green and starring Nicolas Cage. Butter says that with his vast experience in filmmaking, teaching, and writing about film, Gary will provide centenary moviegoers with the perfect insider's look at film.
6 years ago, the Faith in Film series started, and actually I was the first program director, I guess you would say. The committee came up with an idea to try to have a series of films that were shown in the month of February, sort of jumping off the Oscar thing. Everybody talks about movies in February, and I thought it was an interesting idea. I had just finished working for River Run. I was the director of River Run, and I had some time to plan this. It was really fun. And one of the people on the committee approached me about doing this, and we were talking about, you know, what our benchmark was going to be for this series, sort of where we were going to head with it. And we decided that our very first requirement would be to show excellent films that would have in some way a tie into spiritual life or moral decision making or that sort of thing. So I did the series for 5 years. And then this year, I really wanted some time off. So we came up with the idea to invite somebody else to come in to lead the program. We are so fortunate to have Gary agree to do this. He's very busy right now. He's got a full load teaching, and then he's working on film projects right now. He does a lot of writing. He's been published in the Oxford American, Garden and Guns, and even Paris Match. So, you know, he's a busy person, and I was thrilled when he agreed to come do this.
It seems like this education goes both ways, and that Gary, currently working on this issue of faith as relates to film, talk about that aspect of what he's doing and what he's getting out of this series.
Gary is doing a lot of writing now, and one of the things that has always been of interest to him is religion and film. And he has been working on a book for a long time about the nature of faith and the nature of the way we humans deal with life and death issues. So there are films that he has targeted that he feels are really compelling in terms of dealing with these kinds of issues. And so the four films he selected, he uses in his curriculum at Duke every single year. They're films that he feels like are very important and demonstrate different ways people think of their spirituality and the decisions they make day in and day out, what motivates them. And at the core of it is life and death, really, in all four of these films.
Time Indefinite by Ross McElwee, a new one to me. Tell me about this film.
Ross McElwee is from the Charlotte area. He is from a family of physicians and highly educated people. He is also highly educated, but he's a filmmaker. And he, I guess, grew up with a camera in his hand. And he ended up going to the Northeast, living there, and he did some camera work for a fellow by the name of Penny Baker, who's a very well-known documentarian, and ended up making a documentary about his own life after he had done some work for other people and now teaches at Harvard. And he continues to make documentaries. They're very personal. Time Indefinite is really the second documentary he had made. He was inspired because he is getting ready to get married. And in the course of the documentary, his grandmother dies. He gets married and he has a son. And I will just say that I believe Ross McElwee is really fascinated with this notion of capturing images that will stay forever, even though the person that you have photographed may not be around anymore.
Every summer since I was a kid, my entire family, uncles, aunts, cousins, everyone, has gathered here on the coast of North Carolina for a week-long reunion. My family's never quite known what to think of the fact that I moved north and even more strangely, took up documentary filmmaking as a profession. I come from a family of doctors, grandfather, father, and brother, and I think that my lifestyle has always seemed a little strange to my family. But everyone always wants me to come to the reunion, and in fact, I somehow managed never to miss one.
Well, another film in the series that certainly deals with life and death issues in a big way, Grizzly Man. And I'm struck by Werner Herzog on so many different levels, but I guess the simplest, the way he captures things so subtly on film that has a huge impact. A grizzly bear happens to saunter up to that tree and scratches himself on that same tree and leaves a little bit of a mark. And you pull back and realize that that bear is 5 feet taller than this man who was just there 20 yards away. It's insane.
Well, there's no doubt that Timothy Treadwell, who is the star, I guess you would say, of this film, the person who actually did the camera work, who lived with the grizzlies for years, he would go to this same place. And you know somebody is not quite in their right mind who would go and live amongst grizzly bears, you know. And I actually asked Gary, I said, why would you choose this film? Because this is a disturbing film on many levels. I mean, this guy was pretty crazy, and he did not survive his time with the grizzly bears, and his girlfriend died as well. So this is not a lightweight film by any means. And he said, well, at one point, Timothy Treadwell is screaming at God because the grizzly bears need water. The salmon can't run. There's not enough water in the stream. And he's really angry with God because he feels like God is not doing right by the grizzly bears. And sure enough, it starts to rain after that happens. Now, that's a tip-off that this guy, Treadwell, does have some sort of faith at some level. He does have some feeling about God. He calls on God to rescue the bears. But one feels that he probably had an inability to interact with other human beings. He felt much more comfortable with the grizzly bears. But so did Francis of Assisi. Francis of Assisi, it was said, could talk to the animals. And so maybe, I'm not saying that Timothy Treadwell is Francis of Assisi by any manner or means, but I do think there's something to this man's need, I mean, really yearning to have this closeness with these gigantic creatures who are so dangerous that he's going to protect the grizzly bears.
We're here in the grizzly sanctuary, but I'm wrapping up my work here in the grizzly sanctuary. Why is that? Because I'm on my way to the grizzly maze, where bears do not have human protection, but are under human threat. Bears like Aunt Melissa, bears like Demon, Hatchet, Downy, and Tabitha, and it's time for me to go to protect them. I wish I could bring Mr. Chocolate with me. You'd be great protection there. He's been with me for over a decade, and he's been my good friend, and I really appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chocolate.
Certainly one of the other great filmmakers, documentary films specifically. I'm thinking of Errol Morris, and one of my all-time favorite films of his, one you don't see often, talked about, there's Vernon, Florida, which came out not too long from this. This was a 1978 film, Gates of Heaven, which is coming up in the film series, but this is the director of Thin Blue Line, a famous film for him. But tell me about Gates of Heaven.
Gates of Heaven is about a pet cemetery, and it's really about the people who take their pets to be buried and the relationship they have with these pets. I haven't seen the film in a while. It's an amazing film. It was his second film, so it's not maybe as polished as some of the later film work he did was, but I read that was reading Roger Ebert's review. He reviewed this film again not too long ago, and he said he puts this film in the top 10 of all of the films he's ever seen. It is ranked in his top 10 list. He said in the review I read that he has seen this film more than 30 times. Every time he sees it, he takes away something else. And he mentions in his review that this film, again, is about life and death. And one lady in the film is talking about her dog, and the dog was there, and then the dog dies, and where did the spirit in the dog go? It's not there anymore.
Because after all, there's your dog, your dog's dead. But where's the thing that made it move? It had to be something, didn't it? There's your spirit, there it is. I might be dead, but I'm not moving. And you can't put that back in him. But I can take the body where it'll be with it and lay it to rest for beautiful thing, and it can rest there or be right around there. It'll stay close, it'll stay where he is, and I'll find it again. I really will.
I've always thought the role of the church to some degree is to prepare us for the inevitable and help us through those times and, I guess, just give it some perspective that we're all going to die at some point. And the film series really, it seems like such a concrete example of that. What's your take on that?
I think that all of us are thinking about, when are we going to die? That day rolls around on the calendar every year, that day that we're going to die, but we have no idea really when it is. One great thing about film is it is accessible to so many people. It works on so many levels. And because it's visual, you know, it's an easy thing for people of all different perspectives to view and then to discuss because, you know, people are really going to disagree about Grizzly Man, and a lot of people thought he was really harming the grizzlies by being so close to them. Other people, in terms of Gates of Heaven, or might say, gosh, what a silly thing that these people would, you know, love their pet so much that they would put them in a cemetery, and then that cemetery goes out of business, so they have to be moved to another cemetery, and or going along with that, it just seems ridiculous. But at the core of it is this yearning for love and for connection with another being and the loss of that. And certainly Ross McElwee is in Time Indefinite, is right there dealing with the very same issues.
Butter Burkus. This year, she hands the reins of Centenary United Methodist Church's Faith in Film series to Duke Professor of Fiction and Nonfiction Filmmaking Gary Hawkins. Faith in Films, with free screenings and discussion every Sunday in February beginning at 2 o'clock, kicks off this Sunday at Centenary in Winston-Salem with Ross McElwee's Time Indefinite. Werner Herzog's Grizzly Man is the following week, and you'll find links to the complete schedule at wfdd.org/triadarts. Each film is for mature audiences. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and when we get back from this short break, we're off to the theater with Festival Stage. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. Theater is a highly collaborative art form in general, but Festival Stage's new production of 33 Variations by Moises Kaufman takes it to a whole new level. The Winston-Salem and High Point-based company, now in its third year, has embarked on an amazing collaboration with Wake Forest University that taps the school's departments of music, history, dance, medicine, and theater to produce Kaufman's Tony Award-winning drama. Performance lectures and exhibits surrounding 33 Variations will be February 1st through the 24th, with an opening night in Haynes Brands Theater on Thursday, February 7th. You'll find links to more information at wfdd.org/triadarts. Wake Forest University Assistant Director and Associate Professor of Theater Brooke Davis and Festival Stage Resident Director Steve Umberger spent 2 years in the planning stages for 33 Variations, and they recently joined me to explain.
Unprecedented is a word that is thrown around a lot, but I said it would not be wrong to say that this is unprecedented. It really hasn't been done at this level, and it was the play that really helped facilitate that. We were trying to find something that neither organization would be likely to do on its own, something that would take really true collaboration. And I had seen this play in New York in its Broadway production, and I thought when I saw it that it was so specific. There's so many aspects of this play that are so specific and demanding that it's not something that you're going to choose lightly or easily. You have to have the guns to really do it. Okay. So when we were sitting around talking about what we might do together, this play came to mind because not only of the theater aspect of it, just it's a good play with good roles, there's also the music aspect of it. The Beethoven's Diabelle Variations are woven throughout the play, so there's a live pianist who has to be involved in this, obviously accomplished. So there was that aspect of it. And then there's a character in the play who has ALS. So that led us, of course, to think about the medical aspect of it. And Wake has one of the country's ALS centers. And it happens that Dr. James Karras, who is the head of the ALS Center, is also a supporter of the Shakespeare Festival and Festival Stage. And we had known him for some years. So all of this began to sort of form right in front of us on the table. It was a really, once we got onto that, onto the title, it began to really be clear that there was a lot of potential in this.
Okay, well, who is this Moises Kaufman? And then let's talk about the play a little bit.
Yeah, Moises Kaufman has done a lot of really notable work over the last 20 years. He's got a theater company in New York called the Tectonic Theater Project, and he really began to be noticed with a play called Gross Indecency, The Three Trials of Oscar Wilde, which had an off-Broadway run, and he had constructed that play based on testimony from the trials. It was not original dialogue per se, it was an arrangement of testimony taken directly from those trials.
And remind us about the trials.
Well, Oscar Wilde was on trial for sodomy, and he went through a 3 or 4 year period where he was engaged in these legal actions, and Moises Kaufman arranged them in a dramatic way. It was a sort of a new way of storytelling that really had not been seen. And it got a lot of attention, and the production ran for some years. And then he did that again with a play called The Laramie Project, which was based on the Matthew Shepard incident in Wyoming. So his company, the Tectonic, began to really make a name for themselves doing this kind of work. And 33 Variations was the next project. And it actually had a Broadway run.
A very successful one.
Yeah. So they got to be even more well-known. And this play is not quite the same storytelling. It's not only historical testimony. He weaves fact and fiction together. So, you know, it's a really fascinating blend of ways of doing plays that, for an audience, it's very unusual, it's very fresh, and it's a hybrid. You've really never seen a play like this before.
Brooke, talk us through, because it's on so many levels, a lot of interest there.
Sure. It's basically the story of a scholar who has been studying Beethoven and his sort of obsession with these variations near the end of his life. And it's paralleling his story with her story as she's battling Lou Gehrig's disease, and the two of them asking some of the same questions. And so one of the things Steve was talking about this play breaking a whole bunch of rules, we've got two time periods simultaneously. We have all kinds of different forms and different structures in this play where we've got sometimes we're in Catherine's mind, sometimes we're in hallucinations, sometimes we're almost in soliloquy, or we're talking directly to the audience. There's all kinds of different things going on in telling the story of this woman who's struggling with a disease and coming towards the end of her life, but also making all kinds of discoveries in the same way that Beethoven was making all kinds of discoveries near the end of his life as well.
I just find the whole underlying theme fascinating, this idea of, in both cases, the researcher and the composer, great loss going on in their lives, obviously, and toward the end of their lives, and yet at the same time, they're just on the cusp of some great realization.
Tremendous gains.
Yeah. And basically the engine of the play for the audience, what they're seeing is Catherine struggling to discover why Beethoven wrote the Diabelli Variations as Beethoven is struggling to finish the Variations.
Right. Mm.
That's what's happening back and forth as the play moves forward. So it's a pretty interesting, you know, shift of time periods as they're both sort of going for the same thing creatively before it's too late.
To bring that off, I should say this is not your grandfather's production. Lots of technological developments that kind of enable the process.
Yeah, because the play shifts so much and has so many different locations and really is not a realistic play per se. A lot of it is in Catherine's mind. The production design is not literal. It allows us to move around very easily. And the set is a series of screens that take light from the front or the back and also projections. One of the people involved in this from the Wake faculty is Jonathan Chrisman, whose job it is to create projections for almost every scene in the play.
So you've got projections designer John Christman from Wake, who's one of the best, and also Louis Goldstein, one of the great pianists of our time, living and working right here on the Wake campus.
Who's been working on these variations for over a year now.
How about
Once
that?
We kind of pulled him aside, I mean, when I first went to him, I said, Louis, do you know anybody who might? And he kind of, in his Louis way, said, well, you know, maybe I might be interested in doing that. I mean, he's just having a blast, but he has talked about it being some of the most difficult work that he's done.
It is. I mean, there are a lot of musicians who consider the Diabelli variations to be among the greatest variations ever done. And Louis reinforced that. You know, I said to him about a year ago, I said, you know, well, how difficult is this going to be? And he said, well, I have to start working right now.
Wow.
You know, to really, really get it.
Along with that sort of excellence, we get excellent actors coming in for this production. And just reading through the bio, I mean, these are seasoned veterans, talking about Allison Edwards and Warren Kelly. Allison, national tours of Wit and also lots of productions with New York Shakespeare Festival and Riverside Shakespeare Festival as well.
Yes.
Fine actor.
Yes. Allison is based in New York. Warren is based in New York. It's a cast of seven. Five of them are based in New York, and two of them are coming from the Wake Forest contingent, one student who's graduated and one who's a current student.
That's a priceless experience, I would think, for the Wake students and grads.
It's kind of like a tennis game. You know, your game gets better if your opponent is better. You kind of rise to the occasion. And I've seen that with these Wake actors as well.
It's a mutually beneficial production in so many ways. It seems like neither of you all could pull this off without the other in terms of the community involvement.
We have been very grateful for Festival Stages is bringing a whole lot to the table. In terms of what Wake is doing, we are lucky that Christina Soriano has been choreographing for a Minuet. We've got Brian Gorlick, who's doing vocal coaching and helped some of our actors with a pretty interesting piece of music that they're going to be singing. Louis Goldstein, as we talked about. Costumes are being designed by Mary Wayne Thomas. We have projectionist John Christman. The set design is Robbie Smith Mullins. And my good friend Leah Roy, who is dialect coach. And J.K. Curry, who is serving as dramaturg for this production.
This is just such a fascinating play. It covers so much terrain. You've got history, you've got science, you've got art. And there's some events that dovetail this as well in addition to the play.
We have a lot of special events that are revolving around the play. You know, we always have pre-show and post-show discussions with the audience, but this time around, those are going to involve some of our consultants and some of the special people who have been involved with this. One of those is William Kinderman, who is a world-renowned Beethoven scholar, who is coming to Wake. He's going to be performing the Diabelli Variations, and he will do at the same time his lecture about the variations. Then he will come and do pre-show and post-show discussion for us. And William Kinderman happens to be the Beethoven scholar who helped Moises Kaufman write 33 Variations originally.
Festival Stage resident director Steve Umberger and Wake Forest University assistant director and associate professor of theater Brooke Davis. The Tony Award-winning drama 33 Variations by Moises Kaufman opens Thursday night, February 7th at Haynes Brands Theater in Winston-Salem. You'll find links to ticket information and more at wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we're going to take another short break right now. When we return, it's all music all the time, beginning with fugue. What's in a fugue, you may well ask? Well, fear not. Peter Karoff's got you covered. He's sitting at the keyboard and just itching to go. And then Fletcher Opera Institute and Piedmont Opera's Jamie Albritton is here to share the magic of Puccini. Ah, Madama Butterfly, La Boheme, and La Rondine, next on Triad Arts Weekend. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and this is our good friend Mr. Peter Karoff at the keyboard.
There's the beginning of an amazing piece of music by Johann Sebastian Bach, composed in the 1720s. And it is written in this musical technique that we call fugue. Fugue is a way, basically, of writing, a procedure in which a melody comes in this case, this one. And then that same melody comes in, usually about five notes higher up. So instead of starting here, it starts up here and goes like this. But of course, the first melody keeps going. And then the same melody comes in again, this time down here. And the first two melodies keep going. And you get the idea. This is called counterpoint. Counterpoint is basically when you have multiple melodies at the same time, different melodies superimposed one on the other, each going their merry little way. And this particular kind of counterpoint is called imitative counterpoint. Imitative in the sense that each melody just imitates the melody before. Fugue was a particularly beloved technique to Bach. He wrote dozens and dozens and hundreds of fugues, pieces in this fugal style, sometimes called simply fugue, and others with different names, but still nevertheless written in this technique. I'd like to keep going through this piece. After the first three melodies have made their first appearance, sometimes you have these little brief interludes called simply episodes. And here's a little episode. Now the three melodies have made their appearance, and they kind of keep going, sort of echoing little fragments of the melody. Can I just take that apart for you for a second? You got your bass notes down here, maybe like a bassoon or something going. And then you have your melody, little fragments of the melody up here. And then the echo melody down here. A little duet. And all three together. Melody comes in, this time buried in the middle, not in the top melody up here, and not in the bottom melody down here, but rather in the middle here. And it all sounds like this. At this point, Bach does a wonderful thing. He takes the bass note and just freezes it for a second and says, don't move those notes, and the other melodies keep moving on top of it. This technique, with a frozen static bass and then moving melody on top, that's called a pedal point. It takes its name from the organ, you know, where you could take your foot and just put it on a low note on the pedal and just hold it there. And it serves as a little tag to this piece. It really emphasizes the home key. Bach just thought in terms of fugue. I mean, every time he wrote a melody, he always thought of how could this melody combine with other melodies? How could this melody combine with itself later on? It's kind of miraculous when you take it apart, and yet, if you can believe it, Bach could actually improvise a fugue on the spot. And we know from historical accounts that people would just give him a melody and he'd sit down and say, yeah, let me think about that for a second, and then come up with these fugues, sometimes three, four, or even five or more separate, distinct melodies echoing one another, moving through all the keys, and creating this beautiful and rich and wonderful imitative counterpoint we call fugue.
Steinway artist and Wake Forest University professor Peter Karoff at the keyboard. That's a little old segment we like to call Understanding Classical Music on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and this is the moment all Puccini fans out there have been waiting for. I saw you and dreamed of love. So confesses the courtesan Magda to the well-to-do Ruggiero in Giacomo Puccini's La Rondine. Things get a little complicated, but along the way we hear lots of gorgeous writing from the man who gave us Madame a Butterfly and La Boheme. The Fletcher Opera Institute at the UNC School of the Arts brings this lyric comedy in three acts to the Triad tonight, February 1st at 7:30. There's a Sunday matinee at 2 and one final performance on Tuesday night, February 5th at 7:30 in the Stevens Center in downtown Winston-Salem. Fletcher artistic director Jamie Albritton spoke with me about Puccini and his operetta-like opera La Rondine. You know, beyond all the pretty melodies and harmonies, Puccini was a pretty influential guy. Long before Starbucks came out with their Just Like a Real Cafe Verismo home brewing system, Puccini was keeping it real with a Verismo of his very own.
Puccini didn't start Verismo. The term comes from the Italian word vero, which means truth, and it's sort of a movement towards the end of the 19th century that was in response, if you will, to bel canto. Now, I don't like my bel canto, to not be so honest, but the voice had become such a governing force in opera and the singers, and it was getting a little artificial, and people said, and the stories were too. I mean, the Grand Duke of some far-off kingdom that nobody knew, they wanted stories that meant something more to them here and now.
When you say bel canto, the emphasis on vocal virtuosity?
Yes, uh-huh. And so to have an emotional moment in bel canto, I would stop and possibly sing a cadenza or some elaborate vocal flourish, which can be, when well executed, every bit as dramatically meaningful. But at the time, music history is moving forward, and they hadn't seen Verismo yet. We didn't know what it was. And again, another piece of that Verismo puzzle, too, is I want a story about people that I know. A king in a far-off country, that's interesting to look at, but what about people that I live with? What about a story that's going to have more of a context to me personally?
If you will, they were still interested in keeping it real in
yes,
the 19th century.
Yes, exactly. Very much so. Yeah. Keeping it vero. So that's part of the era that we're in. Now, Puccini's contribution to that, I would say, excellent theatrical instincts combined with remarkable melodic ability. If you look at an opera like Boheme, it is an exquisitely executed story combined with extraordinary music. Puccini sat down with Leon Cavallo, another composer of the time, and said, you know, Ruggiero, what you doing? What's your next project? And Ruggiero said, well, Giacomo, I'm about to set La Boheme. And Puccini looked across the table and said, that's very interesting. Excuse me. And he went to his staff paper and wrote La Boheme. I've actually been lucky enough to sing in a production of Leoncavallo's Boheme, and it is Verismo. I mean, it's hardcore, serious stuff. It doesn't have the beauty of Puccini's, but the theatrical pacing and the storytelling in Puccini's is so much more masterful. And that sort of was his first hit. Now, that's not, technically speaking, a Verismo opera, but it's approaching it. It's sort of moving its way through. Then once you get to his greatest operas, Butterfly, Tosca, these operas are full-out Verismo. They're really telling stories. You know, if you look at one of the fun things to do when you go to Rome, speaking of Verismo, is take the Tosca tour, because you can head down towards the Vatican and you can see all the real locations that Tosca took place in. You can go to the church and see the church where Cavaradossi is painting the picture. You can run down to the Castel San Angelo and take the tour and realize you couldn't actually do the opera in the castle quite the way it's built, but still great opera. So, I mean, there's so much of a deeper connection to the emotional moments in it. And Puccini really is just the master of arguing with his librettists to give the clearest amount of storytelling and character study, and then finding these magnificent ways to set all of that to melody.
Master of melody. Some of his quasi-contemporaries, I guess earlier, Wagner, Verdi, kind of lionized in their age. How was he perceived in his own day?
He was a rock star. I mean, he was really very comfortable thanks to the income that he made from his works. His music was so popular that you couldn't wait for the next one. That's part of the story of Rondinet, is that his operas were so popular that he received this outrageous commission from a German opera company to write an operetta, and very unusual for Puccini. Usually he would see it, usually it was a play, and say, I love this play, I want to set it to music. I mean, everybody knows in Tosca the moment when she sets the candles down around Cavaradossi's body. Well, that music he wrote because he had seen Sarah Bernhardt do the play La Tosca and said, I want to set this to music. And he had Sarah Bernhardt's performance of Tosca in his head when he wrote that music for her to do that, and it's sort of become part of the tradition of that opera. In the case of La Rondinet, he received this ridiculous commission that, you know, he was riding high. He had his villa at Torre del Lago. He's wearing expensive suits. He's smoking cigars. And the money came, and he said, yeah, that's a good deal. I'll take that. And originally, it was a commission for an operetta, and the subject hadn't been chosen yet. And for Puccini, that was unusual, that he would enter into a contract without knowing what he was going to be writing about.
Before we get into the story of La Rondinet, and there are three versions of it, where does it fit stylistically in terms of his output? And you talked about beautiful melody earlier as an element.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question with La Rondinet, because it was written in 1917. So we're deep into the Verismo period. You know, there's pieces of this that sound a lot like Butterfly. But the thing about it is, it's about two young people. There are three acts, and the first two acts are basically dealing with honest love, a youthful love, a sentimental love. So it has charming moments in it. It has some of the most beautiful melodies that he's ever written. But you recognize the harmonies, you know that music from the other operas, but in this context, it has to somehow find a broader, lighter means of performance. And to my mind, that's one of the big challenges with this piece.
Give me a moment, a musical moment early on in the work, maybe in the first act, that would kind of illustrate, oh yeah, that's Puccini, that's the king of melody we're so familiar with.
There's a famous aria in the very first act. It's the first aria that the leading lady Magda sings, Quil bel sogno. And everybody may scratch their head and say, La Rondinet, I don't know anything from that. But the moment you hear Quil bel sogno, you will recognize that aria, I'm quite sure, if from nothing else, from television commercials. It's the greatest hit, if you will, from La Rondinet. It's such a beautiful aria.
Boy, that is just absolutely gorgeous melody. You can't miss that one.
And, no.
But there's more. I mean, this opera has lots of moments.
If I were to point you to another moment, I would jump over to the second act. It is Puccini's equivalent of Johann Strauss's Dewey Do in the second act of Fledermaus, the Sing to Love chorus, Sing to Love. But it's a moment where sort of everything stops and everybody sings this hymn to love, and that's exactly what happens in the second act of La Rondinet, sort of highlighting the fact that he was looking at his operetta compatriots to try to find the right way to stylize this piece into an operetta. And Ruggiero, the tenor, starts this ensemble. It's a gorgeous piece. Eventually, he brings all of the four principals into it, and he brings the chorus into it, and it's one of those pieces that, at least in Italy, there's a long tradition of encoring the ensemble a second time over, because it's so beautiful that the audiences always request it for a second time.
How about design production?
We're updating the show just a little bit to sort of set in the 1890s, and John Coyne is our faculty designer. He has done an extraordinary job with the sets. It's just really a pleasure to watch this production. It's been executed beautifully. The costumes are stunning. It's really a beautiful show. It lives up to, in all respects, its musical beauty. I mean, the piece has a really interesting history in respect that it was originally to be written for a German operetta house and made its way through several different permutations of its life. But just to sort of always be thinking of it, you know, as I prepared myself to work on this show, the thing I found fascinating was, can you imagine one of Puccini's favorite composers during his lifetime, whose picture sat above him on his piano. That composer was none other than that great master of melody, Franz Lehár.
Oh, yeah, Franz.
And I discovered that amongst the other composers that were approached to complete Turandot, Franz Lehár. And it's just so very obvious to me as he sets all of these beautiful love songs and love melodies, that's what he has in his mind. That's what you're looking forward to coming to see La Rondine. It's a very different Puccini if we get it right. Equally beautiful, every bit as beautiful as any of the operas that he wrote, but it's just such a different flavor, and I think that's one of the reasons why it rests outside the repertoire. I mean, at the end of the day, nobody's dead, and we're so used to blood and guts Puccini, and for at least two of its three acts, it's just soaringly beautiful.
Il bello sogno di Doretta potendo vina, il suo mistero nessun mai scoprì.
Fletcher Opera Institute at the UNC School of the Arts Artistic Director Jamie Albritton. La Rondine opens tonight, February 1st at 7:30 at the Stevens Center in downtown Winston-Salem. There will be a Sunday matinee at 2 and one final performance on Tuesday night, February 5th at 7:30. You'll find links to ticket information and more at wfdd.org/triadarts. Well, that's all for today's program. Our producer and recording engineer is Eddie Garcia, associate producer Bethany Chafin, and you'll find podcasts and archive shows at wfdd.org/triadarts. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the art scene in the Triad, questions, comments, and suggestions. You'll find us on Facebook, and you can drop us an email. The address is triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.